The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Unfortunately, a few people haven't been able to make it here today, but this is going to be a really exciting and interesting conversation. So let me just introduce to you the speakers that we have today. This is Richard Smith. He wrote his dissertation on China's market reforms and has published articles on China's transition to capitalism and environmental consequences in the New Left Review, the Real World Economic Review, and other publications. He's the author of Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. And then responding to him is going to be Mark Selden. Mark Selden is the editor of the Asia Pacific Journal, a senior research associate in the East Asia program at Cornell and at NYU's Asia Pacific American Center, and professor emeritus of sociology and history at Binghamton University. His books include China in Revolution, The Yan'an Way Revised, Chinese Village, Socialist State, and Chinese Society, Change, Conflict, and Resistance. He is completing a book on Apple, Foxconn, and China's rural migrant workers. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Richard to see what he has to say.
Yeah, I'm sorry for the false advertising. I really thought we'd have Judith Shapiro here. She's the expert on China's environment. But I have much less ambition. I'm just trying to I'm going to offer an interpretation for why the question. My book, my project, this paper here, China's Communist Capitalist Ecological Apocalypse and Real World Economic Review. If you look at Google that, I wanted to bring some pictures, but there's a lot of pictures in there. The photos are really, really interesting. So people could look at that, and I'm going to turn this into a book for Verso. So that's the point of this little project here, and this is kind of a chapter, basically a chapter. So the question is, why is China pollution so much worse than normal capitalism elsewhere? What are the drivers, the barriers to change, and what can be done? So I'm going to try to cover this in about half hour, maybe a bit more, but we'll see. And I'll try to make it as quick as I can. Okay, first, the positive. There's no doubt that China's incredible achievements. In just 3.5 decades, barely more than a single generation, China has been transformed from an agrarian socialism in poverty into the world's second industrial power, the leading manufacturing economy, the leading exporting nation, the top maker and consumer of steel, cars, smartphones, and many other commodities. Mao's peasant party put a space station in orbit and a robot on the moon. From a country with mostly dirt roads in the 1980s, China built the world's largest express highway system in a bit more than a decade. China built the world's largest high-speed rail system in about 8 years' time that covers more miles than all the rest of the world put together. While New York has struggled for decades to finish the Second Avenue subway, China installed entire subway systems in 22 cities in less than a decade. Six-story buildings go up in 24 hours, 57-story skyscrapers in a few weeks. Google it, you'll see this. Entire cities are built practically overnight. The People's Daily calls this China speed. Under Xi Jinping, China's state capitalism is now aiming to lead the world economy in innovation, automation, smart manufacturing, robots, renewable energy, chips, and so forth. In January, China's sovereign wealth fund offered to help out poor Donald Trump by investing $1 trillion in rebuilding America's infrastructure and roads, public bridges, and other public works. Incomes have also grown. Hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty, and China now counts a middle class of around 2.25 million, two-thirds the size of the whole U.S. population. By so many indices, China's rise has been breathtaking, really incomparable. Yet China's economic system is also inexorably driving the country to ecological collapse at China speed, rendering more and more of it unlivable, driving those who could afford it to emigrate to Vancouver, Sydney, New York, while the country's relentlessly growing CO2 emissions threaten to accelerate global warming beyond and hasten planetary collapse. It's got help, of course, the United States, but China's emissions are double those of the U.S. with a GDP just 63% of the U.S. With just 18% of the world's population, China emits 30% of global CO2 emissions. It burns more coal than the rest of the world combined. Despite a slight drop in coal production since 2014, China's emissions have not fallen. You've seen pictures of air apocalypse, I'm sure, in winters of 2013, 14, 15, and 16, each heating season worse than the one before. This year, the whole northern half of the country, 500 million people, were blanketed with smog for months on end, most of months on end. Tens of thousands of smog refugees fled south and out of China to Malaysia and Australia and so forth. And there's worse to come. with the dozens of new coal gasification bases, China is trying to get the pollution out of Beijing. The leaders are trying to get the pollution out of Beijing by shifting it to the west, to Xinjiang, Mongolia, and so forth, in a bid to shift pollution out. These plants will burn coal in place and convert it to syn fuels and pipe that to Beijing. If you look at my paper, you'll see the charts from the IPCC about this. Scientists say that if these plants come online, this will doom the planet. They're bigger than the Canadian tar sands field by a lot. They're some of them the size of Connecticut. Ironically, what's interesting is that China is the world's leading producer of solar panels, wind turbines, and has the largest installed capacity of both of these. Yet, they produce trivial amounts of electricity in China itself. In 2016, wind accounted for just 4% of electricity generation, solar barely 1%. Lots of headlines about all the new solar wind installed capacity China's adding, and that's true, but from a very small base. Plus, they're adding fossil fuel capacity almost as fast as solar and wind. There was a headline on the People's Daily the other day that China just opened the world's largest fossil fuel power plant. Something wrong with this picture. Greenpeace reported more important than the installed capacity is the actual production. And in 2015-16, new fossil fuel plants added 111 terawatts, that's like a trillion watts, of electricity production, while wind and solar together added just 84 terawatts, 24% less. Greenpeace reported that just a few days ago, that 30 to 38% of China's renewable energy is wasted, dumped, because it isn't connected to the grid, because local officials prefer coal. We'll come back to this. Xi Jinping has pledged to increase the share of China's electricity production by 20% to 20% by 2020. But this is not happening fast enough. And even if it was, it would be far too slow to stop global warming. If the air is bad, the water is worse. China's freshwater sources are contaminated by pesticides, industrial chemicals, heavy metals, myriad toxins. Urban and freshwater water courses are heavily polluted. Sewage is routinely dumped untreated in the nation's rivers, the same rivers many cities take their drinking water from, imperiling the health of millions. China's Geological Survey reported in 2013 that 90% of the country's groundwater is polluted, 60% of it severely. A survey of 11 cities across China found that 64% of water sources were severely polluted, 33% moderately polluted, and only 3% could be graded as clean. At least 20% of the farmland has been declared unfit to grow food. In May 2013, the Food and Drug Administration in Guangzhou found 40% of rice served in restaurants tainted with cadmium. Okay, in the 1990s and 2000, in response to anti-pollution protests in the cities, the government pushed dirty industries out of the cities and into the countryside and rural towns. This brilliant move resulted in a horrific contamination of whole regions and mass production of cancer villages, 459 by count of NGOs, in every province except Qinghai and Tibet. The problem with water pollution, unlike air pollution, is that once the rivers and lakes and groundwater is polluted, heavy metals and so forth, they can't easily be cleaned up. There's just no possible remediation. This means that much or most water is unsafe to drink in extensive areas of China's farmland are effectively doomed for generations. It's difficult to overstate the implication of this damage. It poses a mortal threat to the society, and it's largely unreported here, and also, in China it's more reported, but still. China's economy is also ravenously consuming natural resources at a far faster rate than any other capitalist economy. With 18% of the world's people, China's industries consume 32% of marketed resources of cement, metal ores, industrial minerals, fossil fuels, lumber, and so forth. China consumes half the world's coal, a third of the world's oil, and its industries use 3 times as much energy per dollar of GDP as the US, 4.5 times as much as Japan. Zombie steel mills produce steel that even China can't use, so they dump it on the market at below cost year after year. Zombie aluminum mills have produced a mountain of ingots in the Mexican desert, where they're trying to get it in, pretend it's Mexican instead of Chinese so they can get around national quotas. China's builders build empty airports, near empty high-speed trains, subways, redundant ports, entire ghost cities complete with miles and miles of empty apartment blocks, shopping malls, office buildings, museums, hospitals, universities, but almost no people. Right now, China planners and builders are at work constructing, building 3.4 billion new homes in a country with just 1.4 billion people, and most of whom have already been rehoused since the 1980s. To make matters worse, officials routinely ignore central government orders to restrain and clean up pollution, shut down polluting plants, turn on sewage filtration plants. So what's going on here? Why can't a police state that so efficiently censors the internet, suppresses dissidents, enforce its own, why can't it enforce its own environmental regulations, stop its own state-owned companies from dumping toxic waste into rivers and lakes? Why can't the government force its own officials to shut down coal-fired power plants, turn on sewage filtration plants? Why can't the government's bureaucratic central planners at least force a rapid shift to wind and solar? After all, this is a centrally planned economy under a dictatorship. Lots of Western pundits have said, I'm sure you've seen this, that, well, at least China's authoritarian, maybe authoritarian, but at least they should be able to get things done. But they don't seem to be able to get things done. I'm going to argue that, at least in this respect, I'm going to argue that the answers are to be found in the nature, contradictions, and tendencies, and systemic barriers to change built into China's hybrid bureaucratic collectivist capitalist economy. I'm highlighting the economic drivers at the central level, central government level, and the local level of resource consumption and out of control pollution. Okay, so explaining this is pretty complicated since China is the most complicated economy in the world. There was an academic, I think, who wrote an article called China's whatchamacallit economy, but I haven't been able to find that particular article. Okay, so first, the China's economy, just a survey of the economy, just the overview here, we have basically a tripartite economy today, talking about the industrial economy, not the agriculture. First, the bureaucratic collectivist core, the commanding heights, the banking, large-scale industry, manufacturing, heavy industry, metals, shipping, aviation, aerospace, rails, roads, ports, all that kind of stuff. And that is mostly all in governments, in key industries, state-owned industries, control between 75 and 100%. 96% in telecom, 91% in power generation, 76% of petroleum and petrochemicals, 76% of airlines, and so on. This constitutes about half the Chinese economy, the bureaucratic collectivist core, the commanding heights. The subcategory of that, very interesting subcategory, since China got rich in the 90s and 2000s, the government has bought up hundreds of foreign companies, natural resource assets, mines, oil wells, properties, Smithfield Farms, Volvo, tech companies like Syngenta, KUKA Robotics, they just bought a few weeks ago in Germany, it's the leading robotics company in the world. Many bought for strategic reasons to get resources and technology China need, others just to get a better return than sitting in treasury bonds, and others as vehicles for corrupt princelings and rich cadres to get their money out of the country. Second sector is the foreign invested sector, mostly the light industrial manufacturing, but also autos, tech tools, textiles, garments, all that, electronics and so forth. That's about 30% of the economy. And then the private sector, around about 20%, but no one really knows. I mean, there's so many private industries owned by shell companies that are, you know, money from the princelings and the rich cadres. We don't really know how much of all this is private. Anyway, it's mostly small businesses, but there are some larger businesses like Alibaba, which is like China's eBay. And then there's a subcategory of the private sector of state-backed investing companies. And that's like Huawei, which is China's most successful multinational telecom industry. It's actually the world's biggest telecom industry. China Vanke, house building, makes them the world's biggest house builder. Anbang Insurance, which bought the Waldorf Astoria, Dalian Wanda, which bought Hollywood's AMC studios, cinemas. All this is presided over by China's ruling class, the elite families of the 88 million member Communist Party. They're bureaucratic collectivists who run a mostly state-owned, mostly planned economy that also produces for market. Caveat, though they do, there are caveats to everything. You can't say anything about China without caveats, because something's true, almost anything is true about some part of China's economy sometime. But in this case, they are also, to some extent, state capitalists in that they own these foreign companies that are actual capitalist corporations. State Grid and Sinopec are not state capitalists. They're bureaucratic collectivists. Okay, so they own all this collectively. And this collectivist ownership is in a context of a lawless internal political regime, which is, I contend, the key to understanding the whole problem of out-of-control pollution and resource consumption and corruption. So first, let's look at the top-down drivers of excessive growth and pollution in China. From the start, from the revolution, from day one of the revolution, the Chinese, of the success of the revolution, the communists have had to be national developmentalists. People who know something of Russian history know that the Bolsheviks looked to international revolution. They hoped that they could spread the revolution to Germany and get the German locomotive to link up with Russia so they wouldn't have to exploit the workers and peasants to industrialize. Well, that didn't work out. But who knows if it could have worked out, but it didn't work out. But Mao didn't count on this external help. Though he did get some help from the Soviets in the 50s. He aimed to industrialize China on the basis of its own resources, on the basis of voluntarism and essentially exploiting the workers and peasants to pay for industrialization. Mao's party state nationalized the economy in the 50s, abolished private property, markets, installed central planning modeled after the Soviets. They divided the country up into vertical hierarchies stretching from the center down to the villages, townships and villages, and municipalities, like spokes radiating from a wheel. Central planners sent down targets and quotas, and they confiscated all surpluses for redistribution, all produce and surpluses for redistribution elsewhere in the economy. Local officials and SOE state enterprise managers were responsible for meeting assigned targets and quotas and rewarded and promoted on that basis. And they began economic planning with the first five-year plan in 1953-57, kind of basic industries, iron, steel, coal, cement, electricity, and so on. Mao strove for extreme self-sufficiency in China, autarky, and voluntarism, and he pushed the voluntarism to the limits in the Great Leap Forward when he insisted that China could overtake Britain and catch up with the U.S. in just a year or so of intense effort. That brilliant system decision cost the lives of 30 to 50 million peasants. Mao's policies also caused plenty of environmental problems. I'd recommend people look at Judith Shapiro's Mao's War Against Nature. But his industrial pollution wasn't so much, because his industries were dirty, but there weren't very many of them, and they were small, so the pollution was limited. Deng Xiaoping, however, ditched Maoism, abandoned autarky, and introduced market reforms, and threw the economy open to Western investment. But he didn't privatize it. There are no privatization to oligarchs in China like in Russia. The Dengists were, in fact, shocked and horrified by Gorbachev's privatization and determined to avoid that error. So their strategy was to maintain state ownership, most of the economy, keep planning, most of the economy, establish priorities, build up sectors, introduce new technologies and industries, but to use the market as a supplement and to correct the plan, in particular to discipline the enterprises, what they call the planned commodity economy. This strategy was inherently contradictory from the start. It exacerbated many existing problems while compounding these with new problems of capitalism, and the process massively expanding resource over consumption, waste, and pollution. Where it was successful, the brilliant success of the market reform program was the special economic zones, which then subsequently spread to all over China. Instead of turning China into a planned commodity economy, what Deng effectively did was created two economies. He created a capitalist market economy within the framework of the state planned economy. Okay, and then that spread. So, but anyway, they're essentially, you could say you have one country, two systems here within China. The special economic zones, the government supplied the infrastructure. This is what's different between China and India, for example. The government supplied massive infrastructure, rails, telecoms, ports. They built all this stuff. And they supplied tens of millions of migrant workers who worked 16-hour days for 7 days a week for 7 cents an hour for decades. And the police state kept them kept their wages in line and prevented unionization until workers began fighting back in the 2000s. This turned the coastal provinces into the light industrial workshop of the world, turned trade deficits into surpluses, and powered China's rise, and saved and enriched the Communist Party. In 1978, China's GDP was $218 billion. By 2016, it was $11.2 trillion. The U.S. is about $18 trillion, 17-something. Per capita, in 78, it was $228. 2016, it's $8,000. Exports were 5% of GDP in 1980. They're 36% of the economy today. Trade deficits turned from deficits, throughout the 80s they ran deficits. By the 1990s, this turned to surplus. $100 billion in 2005, $298 billion in 2008, $382 billion in 2014. Their foreign exchange reserves soared from like a little over $1.5 billion in 1978 to $3.8 trillion, the biggest foreign exchange hoard in history in any country in 2014. China's rise, powered by these exports, that's what's different between China and the USSR or North Korea for that matter. The capitalist sector has just one imperative, one maximand, to use economists speak, to maximize profits. The state sector, China's rulers, the Communist Party, they have a different imperative. Their imperative is to maximize the security, wealth, and power of the Communist Party, and that's not the same thing. To do this, they've had to maximize state-led development, maximize jobs, and promote consumerism. So as foreign investment and forex exchange rolled into China in the 1990s and 2000s, China's leaders spent on vast infrastructure projects, rails, roads, subways, ports, telecoms. They splurged on pharaonic prestige projects to showcase the Communist Party, promote nationalism and patriotism. They opened up new markets in Asia, Africa, Europe, and are countering the U.S. in Asia. The eighth and ninth, the five-year plans give you kind of a rough idea of this. The eighth and ninth five-year plans in the 1990s prioritize oil, iron, steel, transportation, energy, autos, ports, and airports. The Three Gorges Dam was built in that period. The 10th and 11th five-year plans aspired to make China a leading manufacturer of information technologies, and state-owned enterprises were ordered to focus on import substitution to make China's IT less reliant on the West. The 12th five-year plan, 2011 to 16, that plan is enormous. It ordered up gargantuan, extravagantly wasteful and unsustainable infrastructure project. But I'm not saying all this is unsustainable. It's great that they built subways and bridges and roads and this and that, but they have overbuilt this stuff like massively. So they built a high-speed rail system reaching 45,000 kilometers. But by the way, they can only build this in China. They try to sell this stuff overseas, nobody will buy it because it's so irrational. This stuff is so crazy to build these big high-speed trains that cost a fortune to run and build. And to run them on the corridor between Beijing and Shanghai and Shenzhen, it makes sense. But many other places in China, the trains run half empty or empty, almost empty. They spent huge money on upgrading the auto industry. They built an express highway system of 83,000 kilometers in that plan time. That's like a little bit bigger than the U.S. interstate system. They built dozens of subway systems, a raft of new airports, Beijing Terminal 2, aerospace satellites, the Moon Rover, and then these coal to gas plants, expanded nuclear. They pushed urbanization, kicking hundreds of millions of farmers off their lands to urbanize them. The 13th five-year plan, that's where we're in now, began last year. Xi Jinping's Made in China initiative is a techno-nationalist vision of high-tech self-sufficiency and state-driven innovation. The idea is for China to free itself from dependence on foreign companies, to be self-sufficient in innovation, and then to dominate global innovation and production of IT, automation, robots, smart manufacturing, renewable energy, big data, self-driving car, I'm quoting from that, and so forth. There was a good article in the New York Times a week or two ago about this. And then Xi's new Silk Road, so-called Belt and Road plan, to integrate, to extend China's markets and rebuild the Silk Road, to extend China's market by road and rail and ship to dominate Asia and Europe. So, now, striving for self-sufficiency is no doubt capitalist irrational. But Stalinist police states hostile to free thought, polluted Western ideas, and so forth, tended to not be very great innovators. So China's Stalinists have had to force tech transfer, hack or steal IP. You could call that kind of a payback for the opium wars, I think. And now they're rich. They go out and buy Western companies like Syngenta and Kuka Robotics. But mostly they have to make do with second best industries, not competitive. But this is ratchet and not competitive outside China. These are all these big companies in China are mostly monopolies. This is rational and makes sense in this system because China's rulers are nationalists, not capitalists. Though the caveat about the state capitalist part, yeah? Okay. So while China's National Petroleum, Sinopec, and PetroChina can't compete with ExxonMobil and Shell Oil in extraction and refining technology, at least the Chinese government owns them. Better second best than to let Western multinationals come in and take over the economy. They made the revolution, after all, to end Western domination, not to restore it. As China got rich, China's communists got carried away with delusions of grandeur, too. The People's Daily likes to talk about all of China's first, the world's biggest dam, Three Gorges, the fastest computer, the biggest radio telescope, the biggest high-speed railway, there's all the skyscrapers, the highest altitude railway in Tibet. This one I like. The highest altitude ring road. You know what a ring road is? A ring that goes around a city? Okay, ring road. 100 kilometers featuring 7 tunnels, 27 bridges around, guess what city? Lhasa, Tibet. Population 274,000. That's the same population as Jersey City. Can you imagine a 100 kilometer road with 7 tunnels and 27 bridges around Jersey City? Yeah, okay. The longest, highest, scariest glass bridge, the biggest world's biggest air purifier, that's in a park in Beijing. And a few years ago, China's engineers proposed to build an underwater high-speed railway from Beijing to Seattle.
What?
Yeah, it would go like up through Siberia, then under across the Aleutians, and then back on the land and back down. Yeah, they proposed this. They could do this, you know? Right? But instead of spending money on cleaning up pollution and providing people with breathable air, safe food and water, quality schools so they don't have to emigrate, China's rulers are, in my view, squandering trillions of dollars on vanity projects that waste staggering quantities of the planet's resources to serve no real social need and generate massive, unsustainable pollution. This, too, is not irrational. Like the pharaohs of old, or medieval kings, conspicuous consumption and extravagance wows the masses. It connotes power, prestige, promotes patriotism. Just look at Donald Trump. People buy this crap. Secondly, they have to promote consumerism. The first phase of market reforms in the 1980s were a dud. They produced more corruption than anything else and precipitated the Tiananmen revolt. But after that near-death experience and the fall of the USSR and East Germany, the Dungists resolved to go all out to promote consumerism to get people's minds off politics. So they built up entire industries the Chinese did not need, like automobiles, the ghost cities built for speculation not to live in, bread and circuses. All this is capitalist irrational, not to say socialist irrational, but it's supremely rational from the Chinese rulers' point of view because it keeps people's minds off politics and supportive of the Communist Party. Since the 90s, the state's funded and promoted the car craze, the condominium craze for middle-class investors, the shopping mall craze, the tourism craze, the stock market craze, lately the theme market craze, and on, one after another. Thirdly, they need to maximize jobs. In capitalist economies, unemployment is not the capitalist problem. It's the workers' problem. But China's run by a communist party that was once based in the working class and still claims its right to rule as the sole representative of the working class. China's communists are very often very cruel to their workers, but they can't completely ignore them like capitalist companies do. China has hundreds of millions of industrial workers, and with the economy slowing, the government is terrified at the threat they could pose. So it has to keep employment up. Under Mao, they had full employment, but in the 1990s, to streamline the state industries in the run-up to the WTO accession in 2001, the Dungists finally broke the iron rice bowl, put most workers, or many workers, on short-term contracts, precarious jobs, laid off or retired some 30 million state workers. But they could do this in the 90s because the private economy was booming and there were other jobs for people. Today, despite the advice of Paul Krugman, The Economist magazine, and so on, to let China's, they're always telling Chinese, they should let China's indebted state industries and zombies go bankrupt. This is capitalist rational. But what they don't understand is these people are not capitalists. It's not rational for them to let these zombies go broke. So speaking of, because the government needs to keep up employment, the government finds it rational and necessary to keep them going to maintain stability. So speaking in November 13, 2013, Prime Minister and economic czar Li Keqiang said, employment is the biggest thing for well-being. The government must not slacken on this for one moment. For us, stable growth is mainly for the sake of maintaining employment. So in February 2016, the government announced 1.8 million coal and steel workers would be laid off. Strikes and labor protests immediately spread across the country, and the government backed off. So far, jobs are winning. There are layoffs, for sure, but not mass layoffs. The government is mostly keeping the zombies going and having the more broke ones absorbed by the larger ones and so forth. And that's why China's steel production is still growing year after year, even after the State Council announced that it would close 100 to 150 million tons of steel capacity last year and strictly prohibit the expansion of crude steel making in the next 5 years. That's why China's aluminum output is slated for 9% rise in 2017, even as the world is glutted with Chinese aluminum. That's why China's shipyards are still building huge container ships for state-owned Costco. It's the world's Asia's largest shipper. Even though the shipper doesn't need them and doesn't even want them, and so it goes. None of this is capitalist rational, let alone socialist rational. But in China's hybrid system, growth for growth's sake is rational and necessary, even if it drives us off the cliff. So these are the central government drivers at the top. Those are the main drivers of industrial overproduction, resource overconsumption, and pollution. Then there are the local drivers. And I separate these two because if in most accounts, when you read most commentators on China and the popular press like The Economist magazine or The New York Times or whatnot, they'll say, well, what's going on there is that the leaders want to reform the economy and introduce market reforms and push this and so forth, but they're held up by the resistance of these local authorities, the local guys who are invested in interest. So what I was trying to show here in the several pages, I'm not too bored, was to show you that there are huge drivers for this coming from Beijing. That's where the main drivers are, in fact. Then the local drivers have their own interests here, and I'll just briefly survey those. To spur the local governments and state industries, Deng tried to make them responsible for profits and losses instead of eating out of the same big pot as under Mao. So he gave them incentives, carrots. He reduced the number of defined plan targets. He devolved managerial responsibility onto local governments and state enterprise bosses. They introduced profit sharing, splitting the profits, actually giving most of the profits to local bosses, and freed up some prices, restored markets for many goods and services. The local authorities and bosses have the right to sell over-plan output on the market, the right to invest their retained profits in new production of their choice on the side, and the right to distribute incomes and profits to employees in management. So the government also talked about imposing sticks, holding sticks over them, so if the threat of closure if companies didn't shape up. So in 1978, Deng called on officials and managers to double China's per capita GDP to $500 by 1990, then double it again to $1,000 by 2000, and then double it yet again by 2030 to $52 trillion. Well, they've way overshot that, and $11 trillion already. In 1992, he invited local officials and industry bosses to jump into the sea of commerce and exhorted them to grow the GDP or get out of the way, resign. So there's been this tension here because at the same time, Deng was no less concerned to enforce the state plans to shape national industrialization, all those priorities I just adduced there. There are these two contradictory imperatives. On the one hand, he wants to let these guys loose, but every time they get there, every time the government relaxed its control, local officials would invest in things they need, of course, too, but they invest a lot more in their retained profits on all sorts of extravagant, wasteful, irrational projects, including lavish offices. I have some great pictures of this in the paper. This office of a pharmaceutical company. It looks like Versailles, you know, marbled hallways and walls and ceilings and a grand piano in the huge. It's hard to imagine how much I squandered on this. And that's just one, you know, little office out in some little pokey provincial town. Extravagant, wasteful projects, offices, useless skyscrapers in small towns. Fleets, the local guys compete in the tallest skyscrapers. Fleets of imported cars, luxury cadre housing, the blind growth and blind investment. As they wasted money and resources, the government had to step in, has periodically had to step in to re-centralize, what they call readjustment. So in 1979, Dunn blamed himself for the disaster of the first decentralization in 1978. He said, I'm pretty close to done. He says, Dunn is so blunt, I love him. He says, a little section chief is in the position of signing contracts worth tens of millions of US dollars to the extreme embarrassment of the Central Committee. If we don't approve these contracts, we shall lose face. And if we do, where can we get the money? We must put a break on these practices. The face problem can wait. In 1987, so they had to freeze a $3 billion contract with Japan, including $1 billion down on the giant Baoshan steelworks upgrade. In March 1987, Zhao Ziyang, then Deng Xiaoping's economic czar, said that because enterprise behavior cannot on its own meet the overall state policy, therefore we must implement the three guarantees and the three restrictions. This means we must guarantee the construction of projects included in plan, of productive projects and of key projects, while restricting projects that are outside the plan, non-productive and non-key. So you see the tension built into the. So this whole history of the economy since 1978 has been a history of decentralization, re-centralized. And right now, Xi Jinping has been in a re-centralizing mode since he took office in 2012. Well, the problem was, Dunn granted these officials and bosses this broad freedom to profit from the growing market to keep most profits, but since the Dunnists were determined to build up and renovate and expand their key industries, they couldn't let market forces drive their companies out of business, despite what Paul Krugman says. So despite the verbal threats, they let the officials borrow and spend without fear of bankruptcy. So Dunn's exhortation to maximize growth in a context in which the state industries could not really fail, were guaranteed that loans would roll over and wouldn't go bankrupt, were virtually guaranteed. This is basically all carrots and no sticks. Dunn virtually invited investment manias, blind and irrational growth that undermined his state planning efforts, resulting in staggering waste of resources and pollution and environmental destruction that followed, plus the orgy of corruption that enveloped officials at all levels as they marketized their power to get rich from bribery and embezzlement and selling off state assets and looting state treasuries and ATMs. I talked about the corruption in my paper. I can't talk about it today, but that's really big. That's a big driver of overproduction. I mean, there's one academic I wrote said he thinks that the head of the railway ministry that built all these high-speed railroads was doing it mostly for corruption. Many things are built mostly for corruption because they could just milk these things. They milk subsidies out of the government. Okay, so as Beijing ramped up speeding on spending on dams and water transfer canals and energy and rail projects and houses and promulgated new industries and loosened credit and threw billions of yuan at ministries and local governments, the result was overachievers like local guys, like local mayors and so forth, and party secretaries, like in Mao's day, sought to overfulfill their quotas. So you have this phenomenon of GDP tournaments, okay? In the 11th five-year plan, for example, 2006 to 10, the state set a GDP goal of 7.5%. Every single Chinese economist should show that all of China's 31 provinces set higher targets than this. The average was 10.1%, the highest was 13%, the lowest was 8.5%. This, in turn, has overdriven the national GDP. So China's five-year plan, from 1978 forward, no Chinese five-year plan has called for a GDP rate growth higher than 8%. And yet, this target has been routinely exceeded. In 1983-88, the GDP grew at 11.9% per year, almost doubling to 15.2% in 1985. I mean, and then for two decades, from 1992 to 2011, GDP growth averaged 10.5%, hitting 13 and 14% on the crest of the boom in 2006-07. If promotion was to be based on GDP growth, what did it matter what they were building with the stuff? It all counted for the GDP. Empty piles of steel, coal, empty airports, empty ghost cities, all contributes to GDP and people get promotions. Market reform magnified tendencies to duplication and redundancy. I've only got one more page, people. Every locality acts as if it's a separate country. Just like in Mao's day, devolution in the context of bureaucratic collectivism just resulted in an investment of small-scale, often heavily polluting facilities, producing inferior products using out-of-date technology. Thus, in the 1990s, I think I didn't bring all my pages, but that's good enough. Okay. So in the 1990s, Beijing central planners announced that they would fund the auto industry. Every locality tried to be a Detroit. Local officials in, say, Hebei or Sichuan can't invest in industries in Shenzhen or Beijing. They're not capitalists. Investors. They're bureaucrats in a system. And so their economy is their own bailiwick. So the only way for these local officials to do that without their own automobiles was to build their own automobile industry. And so that's just what they did. So that's why China has 170 automakers. Whereas the United States has the big three plus a few Japanese and German factories. Most Chinese factories produce few cars, some fewer than 1,000 a year, one produces even less than 100, and few companies are profitable, but local officials produce cars, and they kind of pretty much force the sale of those cars in their bailiwicks by putting up essentially kind of market blockades. They get the government, they get subsidies and stuff, and they sell a lot of these cars to the government. So when the government decided, when the government decided in 2006 that wind and solar should account for 8% of electricity generation by 2020, the localities all over China got into the renewable energy business. So by 2010, China had more than 100 wind turbine companies. Producers excess capacity was already over 50%. Yet even as they produce all this wind and solar power, renewable energy is defeated systematically in many areas because the local officials have what they call captive coal-fired power plants that undermine the shift to renewable energy. Local officials strategize to maximize their income by protecting their local economies, which includes their state-owned industries and their local power plants. And first, they also save money by buying power from themselves rather than by producing their own power rather than buying from the outside. Secondly, wind and solar can't be used everywhere, built everywhere. In China, the best locations are for turbines and solar farms are out west in Tibet and Xinjiang, though you see them around. Far from industrial population centers. So they're often unconnected by these transmission lines. That's what Greenpeace was talking about, to get the power where they need. What they need is a whole national smart grid, but that's difficult to build in China, difficult to build in the United States. There are only three grids in the United States. It's difficult here. It's especially difficult in China where so much is compartmentalized. For all these reasons, local officials prefer to keep their own power plants. Even way out west in Xinjiang province, which has more installed capacity than any place else, there a stunning 63% Economic Information Daily report, a stunning 63% of all of China's electricity comes from captive coal-fired power plants, and so on. So that's that, except for the last pages, which I failed to bring. So that's good. But what those pages were was talking about, well, why is it that the officials can't, why can't this dictatorship stop this? Well, first of all, they don't allow any independent organization against it. They arrest environmental activists and their lawyers. And then secondly, these people are, all these people, these local officials, all these people, you have to understand that these people are part of the same collective ruling class as the people in Beijing. They are connected by guanxi, there's no rule of law in China. Where there's no rule of law, there's only the rule of men. People are connected by guanxi, by connections in the system, and that means that people, if you have good connections, good and so forth, you can defy Beijing, and so people do regularly defy Beijing. And so that's the first side of the problem. The other side of the problem is that Beijing itself is ambivalent about its program of trying to stop this overproduction and so forth, because they need the jobs. The most important thing is they're fearful if they don't have people at work. They can be private employers, not just state jobs, private jobs. They're trying to do everything they can to generate jobs, and including trying to get people to go out and work on their own, you know, to become their own entrepreneurs, not unlike this country. So for these reasons, they can't really stop this, these trends, these tendencies. Okay, so I've spoken much too long, I'll stop there.
All right, thank you. And now I'm gonna turn it over to Mark Sullivan, who's gonna respond.
Well, this is sizzling, Richard. You've heard the most powerful critique of Chinese development that you're ever going to hear anywhere, even without the missing pages. And I want to comment on it from a number of angles. Where I really want to go is to somewhere that you're not contemplating much at all. I want to pose this as a global problem. And I want to talk about why the problems of overcoming irrational production defy us, and why they defy the socialists as well as the capitalists, as well as the anarchists, as well as most of the environmentalists as well. But let me say a few things about Chinese development first, just to cool it down a little bit. I mean, you know, you've had the irrationality, and we know many dimensions of this. Richard concedes some gains, but let's recognize them a little more clearly. Yeah, you started with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Relax. I'm talking now. You don't have to worry. So, we have a record of recent decades of China moving into a middle-income country, of industrializing to become the workshop of the world, at the same time that, of course, a range of critical problems confront the country. And those include ones that he has emphasized, not only the irrationality, but also the perpetuation of deep division between rural and urban people, at the same time that you have 300 million rural migrants. Like all of these things, China has more than the rest of the world combined in so many areas. But I simply want to recognize what some of these achievements have been, not only in the areas of production, but also, for example, you don't bother to mention that annually over the last decade, China has significantly boosted minimum wages for the working class.
Yeah.
So there are reasons, and these are important in what I want to say, because it puts on the table the issue that I really want to talk about, which is why it is so difficult in China, in the United States, in Europe, places that are much more rational than they are or than we are, to in fact deal with the problems. You're talking primarily about problems of waste and overproduction. I want to put these primarily within the category of climate crisis, environmental crisis, and think about what the fundamental contradiction that makes it so difficult, in fact, anywhere, to step back. It seems to me that you've mentioned it, and that's the question of jobs. Point number one. Point number two is the question of consumption. within this critique of overproduction and waste, which is indeed massive, there also is a desire, not just by communist bureaucrats, not just by bureaucratic collectivists or state officials, but in fact by John Smith and Joe Lee to want to have what they understand to be a better life. Richard and I are both impressed by the fact that 30 years ago you could bike across Beijing in half an hour. Now you can go by car maybe in 4 hours because you're going to have wall-to-wall gridlock. But somehow, just as Americans in their supreme irrationality think that what they want is gas guzzlers and SUVs and so on, the Chinese want to consume as well. So I'm trying to think through why the contradictions are quite as deep as they are. And I think that at the heart of this, almost certainly, is that we, including the left, including progressives and others, have yet to come up with a program that can deal with the problem of, okay, we recognize the climate crisis requires that we scale down. We recognize that irrationality and overproduction requires that we scale down. How do we tell this to the working class? What happens to jobs if we in fact put this in? More to the point, how do we rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, so to speak, by which I'm referring somewhat obliquely to who gets to consume what? How do we take the overproducing countries like the United States and redistribute so that not only the poor here but the poor in other countries can continue to gain? Obviously, these are tremendously, you know, especially at the world that we're looking at now, where internationalism is disappearing and every country is claiming it's going to be the greatest, and so forth, this becomes all the more difficult. But I'm trying to go from the irrationality of hyper-consumption and the irrationality of the climate crisis that is in part the product of that overconsumption to thinking about what it would take to develop alternatives to it that the working class, that people everywhere, that consumers can buy into as well. And I think that we haven't yet begun to answer those questions or even to frame them in ways that are rational and humane. So that's the agenda that I think we can take away. In some ways it goes beyond what Richard is saying by placing the environment right at the center of this. It becomes a global problem that can't be addressed. And it can't, so, you know, I'm tremendously indebted to our great environmentalists, right? You know, the Bill McKibbins and so forth and so on, the Michael Clares and so on. But I have to say that none of them have yet addressed the problem, I feel, that I'm putting on the table now, which is how do we deal with environmental crisis when it means rethinking the question of jobs, when it means rethinking consumption overall. And this is where I want to try to think through beyond what we've been hearing today about Chinese irrationality. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. So we have a little bit over half an hour left.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.